Hi, I'm Dr. Dale Collar. I'm a pulmonologist and sleep specialist, works at Holland Hospital for their medical group, and we're here today to talk about obstructive sleep apnea. To get started, first let's take apart what actually we're talking about. What is obstructive sleep apnea? It just means collapse of your throat while you're sleeping that causes cessation or a stop in respirations, which means we end up choking from that standpoint. We'll be talking about today what causes it, how we diagnose it, some of the treatment options that we have for it, and why we actually have concerns with people who have sleep apnea. To start with, let's look at how prevalent it is. For obstructive sleep apnea, there's current studies that would approximate about 20% of the population actually is affected by this disease. It's fairly equally split between men and women, with men being about 22% of the population and women about 17%, which makes it on par with many other disease processes that you may be more familiar with, things like high blood pressure, diabetes, high cholesterol. So it is something that's prevalent, it's out there, and we need to be looking for from that. Why do we worry about sleep apnea? It's probably the primary question, and we worry about it really as it affects people in two different ways, both from their quality and quantity of life. So people with sleep apnea have a significant decrease in the quality of their life and experiences. We see people with the sleep apnea have increased risks of developing anxiety, depression, short-term memory loss, chronic fatigue. There's increases in things like suicidal ideation, post-traumatic stress disorder, and many, many of the other mental disorders. And this is based on the fact that the sleep apnea decreases your quality of sleep and therefore makes it less effective, which affects us mentally from that. We also have the other side of the coin, which is the quantity of life effects of sleep apnea. So folks that have sleep apnea are at a five-fold increased risk of having heart attacks, a seven-fold increased risk of having strokes, have increased risks of either developing or having harder to treat high blood pressure, diabetes, high cholesterol. We have other heart issues with increased risks of having congestive heart failure, irregular heartbeats, things like atrial fibrillation and atrial flutter, pulmonary hypertension, which is a high blood pressure between the heart and lungs, and increases in risks of kidney failure. Also, if we look at obstructive sleep apnea over populations, which means over many groups of people, we have increases in things like motor vehicle accidents. In fact, in the state of Michigan, there's seven times more motor vehicle accidents by patients who have obstructive sleep apnea than untreated than the general population from there. Also, if we look at populations having sleep apnea that is untreated, increases the risk of death every year by about 50%. So, what things should make us worry that someone might have sleep apnea? There's a lot of things that come both from the patient as well as from their bed partners, and those are things like loud snoring, daytime sleepiness and fatigue, disruptive or non-refreshive sleep, things like insomnia, nighttime gasping and choking, witnessed apneas or witnessed times of choking, morning headaches, and then there are some physical signs that also lead us to worry about sleep apnea. The size and thickness of someone's neck can increase the risk. Females with more than a 16-inch neck have a much higher rate of sleep apnea, while males with a 17-inch neck have a higher risk of having obstructive sleep apnea. And also folks that are overweight have increased risks of developing this disease process. What other things do we find often that people complain of that leads us to asking the questions about sleep apnea? It would be chronic fatigue, daytime sleepiness, presence of anxiety or depression, changes or decreases in cognition, increased trips back and forth to the restroom at night, social conflicts that arise over snoring in the bedroom, and actual changes in personality. So, now we know a little bit about why we worry about it, maybe we can talk a little bit about what actually causes this to happen. All right, during sleep, we only have so much rooms in the backs of our throats to breathe through. Things like increased neck size and decreased or narrowing of the airway can cause that space to be less. And then when we fall asleep, the muscles around that area start to relax, further narrowing down the airway. If we continue to breathe, we push air through the narrow opening, which causes vibration noise. What we also often see in the sleep apnea is that noise stops, and we get complete collapse of that airway or a choking. Now, this can happen many, many times in an evening, and actually the person it's happening to will have absolutely no idea that that's going on because they're asleep for that time period. During each of those times that the back of the throat closes off, there are many different things that go through and happen to the body during that time. Every time that closes off, it's very similar to if someone was being choked. You have an increase in heart rate, an increase in blood pressure, a decrease in oxygen levels, an increase in carbon dioxide levels, and all of these things are seen as a stress by the body. The body responds to this by generating a response with an adrenaline surge, which brings that patient out of deep sleep into the area just between awake and asleep. When the muscles kick back in, we get an opening of that airway, patient starts to breathe or gets the big snort, and then as they start to drift back to sleep, we'll start to snore again. That will happen again with a close off, and it comes and goes all through the night. And this can happen hundreds of times in one night to the person, causing an increase in stress and fragmentation of their sleep. Okay, so how do we actually diagnose sleep apnea? We first start by asking the right questions. Okay, do you snore? Does your snoring ever wake you up? Has anyone ever told you quit breathing when you sleep? Are you sleepy or fatigued during the daytime? Have you had any memory loss? Do you have morning headaches? All important things to know whether it's right to make the next step, which would be to start to do an appropriate physical exam. Look at characteristics. What is the neck size? Is it larger than 16 or 17 inches? Is the patient overweight? Do we have a narrowing in the back of the throat? If there's enough of those things positive, then that history and physical raises the concerns for the obstructive sleep apnea. At that point, then we need to proceed on to do some testing to actually prove if it's there or not. Currently, there are two general types of testing that can be done for obstructive sleep apnea. We have in-lab sleep tests as well as home sleep studies. Each of these tests has their own strengths and weaknesses. We'll go over those in a minute. But a careful evaluation by a physician who at least has some training in sleep medicine is important for picking the appropriate test to get the appropriate answer to be able to make a determination of whether they have sleep apnea or not. The in-lab test, that's the oldest of the tests and probably the most scientific of the tests that is currently done. It consists of wearing monitoring equipment in an attended sleep lab overnight. The sleep rooms that are used for these tests are set up like hotel rooms. Regular beds, TVs, cable TV, furniture, your own restroom, walk-in bathroom, walk-in shower. So to make an apartment to make you feel as much to home as you possibly can. Then there's wires that are attached to various places within the body, including the scalp, the chest, the hands, the legs, in terms to monitor brainwave activity, breathing activities, oxygen levels, movements that happen during the night. For these tests, there's a technologist who's present during the entirety of the study to make sure the monitoring equipment is working appropriately and that the patient's needs are met. We're going to switch to home sleep testing. We'll talk about that for a minute and then we'll do a comparison. So for a home sleep test, it's actually equipment that is loaned to the patient where they take it home and use it in their own bedroom. Generally, these tests consist of about four pieces of equipment that are used. There's an elastic belt that goes around the chest, one that goes around the abdomen. On that top belt, there's a small medallion that is a recording device that then has a wire that would go to the finger with a little piece of tape and a red light to measure the oxygen levels and the heart rate, and a small tube that comes out of the top of that device that rests over the ears and on the top lip that'll measure the flow going in the nose and the mouth. These pieces of equipment are very similar to pieces of the equipment for the breathing that's also used in the in-lab test. And what we do is we measure the flow in and out of the nose or mouth. We know with the elastic bands across the chest and abdomen how much force is being generated, and that allows us then to calculate the resistance or the sized opening in the back of the throat that tells us whether there's any collapse, narrowing. It also records snoring, and then we plot that against the pulse oximeter readings to see if we have any of the changes that we talked about that was going on with the sleep apnea stuff from there. So let's take a little look at the difference and the reasons for doing an either in-lab test or a home sleep test. First, in an in-lab test has some advantages of being slightly more accurate of a test because there is someone there to monitor the equipment continually during the test. It also can be used for multiple different sleep disorders, not just for the obstructive sleep apnea. From that, disadvantages, it's generally more disruptive to normal sleep as someone sleeping away from home, and slightly more expensive in terms of testing cost from that. For the in-home test, it has several advantages. It's less expensive, it's more convenient for the patient. Also, it's very much less intrusive, so we get a little bit more normal sleep in our normal environment than we would away from home. The disadvantages, it's only really for the diagnosis of obstructive sleep apnea. It doesn't help us with any other of the sleep issues that we may be diagnosing with a test. And it's slightly less accurate in the fact that the monitoring equipment is not always in perfect alignment as it would be on an inpatient test if there was a technologist who is there for that testing. So, in terms of kind of summing up sleep testing, there are different tests for different reasons. Both have their appropriate places, whatever physician you see who's working through that will use all of that information to pick the right test for you. Many people worry about sleep testing, worrying that whether they'll be able to sleep, whether they'll be able to do the test. It's the easiest test you're ever going to have. You don't have to study. You don't need a number two pencil. There are no sharp objects. All you have to do is be able to go to sleep. There will be enough information 99% of the time on either one of the studies to be able to discern what's going on and whether we have the sleep apnea or not. Also important to not only diagnose whether you have sleep apnea, but also to find out the level or the severity of the sleep apnea you have. And we do that actually using information obtained from either of those two sleep studies, and we use something called an apnea hypopnea index, which is actually just a calculation of the number of times per hour a patient can have decreased breathing or quitting breathing with that. In terms of normal sleep can have up to 5 of these events per hour and still be considered normal. For actual severity of the sleep apnea, we consider mild sleep apnea to be 5 to 15 events per hour, moderate sleep apnea to be 15 to 30 events per hour, and severe sleep apnea is defined as greater than 30 events per hour. And again, important to know the severity because then it allows us to know appropriate treatment options for that sleep apnea. So, treatments based on the severity. We have mild sleep apnea where there are two good non-invasive treatments that we have available. Something called CPAP or continuous positive airway pressure, which is a machine that through a tube generates pressure that then is attached to the patient through a mask or interface that creates air pressure in the back of the throat, which will stop the collapse and therefore stop the sleep apnea. We also have what's called an oral mandibular advancement device, which is just a fancy way of saying that there's a mouthpiece that pushes the bottom jaw forward, which gives us a little bit more room in the back of the throat, hopefully to keep it from collapsing. Once we get to moderate sleep apnea, so that's past that 15 events per hour, CPAP is the major treatment option we currently have. The only other good treatment option for the majority of patients with that that would be surgical would be the placement of a tracheostomy, which is a little severe for what we need in terms of sleep apnea. Also for severe sleep apnea, we have those same options where the vast majority of patients will be tried on and use CPAP at least as a first line therapy. There's some other general treatments that also for all levels of sleep apnea are important. And these are things like weight loss, controlling nasal congestion with that, avoidance of alcohol and sedative medications before the time of sleep, also controlling heartburn and gastroesophageal reflux. We can elevate the head of the bed to make these things better. We can also try to avoid sleeping on our backs, as that always will make snoring worse and therefore then the sleep apnea worse from there. In terms of CPAP, I want to take a minute or two to talk about the CPAP. It is continuous positive airway pressure. It pushes pressure through the nose or nose and mouth, splints open or forms a pneumatic splint or air splint in the back of the throat. Very similar to the same kind of technology we use to fill a bike tire or a car tire. With very little pressure, we're able to support a lot of weight and a lot of distance, keeping that actual airway open so there's no collapse, there's no choking, there's none of the risks that we talked about previously. To institute this therapy, we have a couple of ways of doing what's called a titration or finding the appropriate pressure for a CPAP. It can either be done in the sleep lab with the same devices we talked about for the in-lab test, or now we have some options of doing these titrations actually at home with very specialized machines that change the pressure as they sense that it needs to be changed for the amount of narrowing of the back of the airway, where we can run pressures from 5 to 20 centimeters, whatever it takes to hold open, and then set that CPAP to be chronically at that pressure. The only negative to the CPAP is it must be worn. It doesn't do any good if it's sitting in the corner, or it stays on the bedstand, or it doesn't get turned on. So the biggest problem is actually getting to comfortable enough to wear it on a regular basis. From that, it also does require some periodic follow-up with your physician to make sure the pressures are staying appropriate. Bonus of having the CPAP is it is ultimately titratable, changeable. It can be modified for whatever changes in life with that, so that we can keep up on good treatment for the sleep apnea. The next of the good choices and non-invasive choices for the mild sleep apnea would be to use the oral advancement device. It is a device that pulls the jaw forward, keeping more space, also keeps the mouth from being open and does increase the amount of breathing we do through the nose, which actually helps to open up the back of the throat from there. In order to get started with an oral device, it must be fitted and made by a qualified dentist. And that is a limited select few dentists that have had appropriate training in how to first make these devices and adjust them. Once these devices are used, it requires regular follow-up both with your dentist and with your physician. Mostly, your follow-ups are to monitor for some of the complications that can come with the oral devices, and that's with the development of something we call TMJ, which is an irritation of the jaw joint, which sometimes can lead to chronic headaches and chewing issues and pain, as well as use of a mouthpiece on a regular basis sometimes can cause misalignment of the teeth, and so it has to be changed and checked on a regular basis. If an oral device is to be used, then it does require, after it's been made and put in place, that a home sleep study be completed with the mouthpiece in to make sure that it effectively has treated the sleep apnea. There is a question that often comes up of a new device called Inspire. It's been advertised quite widely recently. And I want to take a minute to at least address it, because it is one of those things that, does come up. It is a non-CPAP way of treating sleep apnea. However, it is very limited in what it actually is to treat. So it is an implantable device, so it means it needs to be surgically placed under the skin, and it then has a wire that runs from that implant up into the back of the throat, which stimulates the muscles in the back of the throat. And as we talked about, when patients fall asleep, they lose some of that muscle tone and therefore sometimes get the apneas from there. The limitations to this device is that it is only limited to a very few patients. It must be patients 21 years of age or older. They must have moderate to severe sleep apnea. They must not be overweight, so they must be at ideal body weight. And they must have previously failed or proved to be intolerant to either an oral device or CPAP therapy from that. So with this new device, there's a very limited population that actually qualifies for it. It is an invasive procedure that requires a surgical visit as well as placement of wire up into the back of the neck and throat. It at maximum can decrease the apnea hypopnea index that we spoke about early by 80%. So therefore, if we started with a high AHI anyways and we only reduced it by 80% and it still remained above 5, as we talked about the numbers before, you still would have sleep apnea even with the device in and still carry all the risks of the heart attacks and the strokes and the sleep deprivation that we talked earlier with that, and its cost is currently between $40,000 and $45,000 for placement. So it does have a very limited role and should only be used during treatment of fairly severe disease with failure of our non-invasive treatments from that. So, treatment summary. What do we have for options? Well, those options are based on severity of disease. For mild disease, we do have more options than we do for moderate or severe disease. For, again, the mild disease, we have the CPAP or the oral device. For moderate to severe disease, we have starting with continuous positive airway pressure or CPAP. Once you start CPAP, we maximize its compliance, meaning to use as much as possible with that, at least as an initial goal to get the physical benefits is 4 hours a night. 7 out of 10 nights will at least decrease our risks of physical problems, meaning the heart attacks and the strokes. Weight reduction is also helpful, as well as avoiding any kind of set of medications at the time of sleep. The alternative treatments then again were the oral device and the fairly new device, the Inspire, which we'll continue to monitor if it's able to be more useful as we go on in treatment over the years from that. All right, so just a little summary, kind of go over kind of the big points of things that we've talked about today. One, OSA or obstructive sleep apnea is a very common disease, very underdiagnosed at this point with that. It has been linked to many serious health issues. It can affect both quality and quantity of life. It has a fairly distinctive history and physical exam with that. It is something that needs to be diagnosed with a test, and the treatment of OSA can reverse all of the quality and quantity issues if it's done appropriately and we completely obliterate the sleep apnea with either the CPAP, oral device, or other treatment from that.